I'm Graham Allison. I'm going to serve as the moderator of the event, and we have an absolute treat for you this afternoon. So we have two extraordinary individuals and two outstanding books, and the purpose of the session is to give you a chance to hear enough about them that if you're as enthusiastic as I am, at the end, the best thing you can do for the authors is not only to say thank you, but to buy their book, which will be on sale at the back of the room with copies to be signed, and read the book, and then send them an email and tell them what you think of it, or further questions. So, alphabetically, Jim, who's Sabinius, is a professor at the Harvard Business School and the Kennedy School, has written an extraordinary book on Kissinger the Negotiator, Lessons from a Dealmaker. And Jim is going to tell us about lessons from the book that might be relevant for folks like us. And interestingly, this is not about good or bad Kissinger. This is about what we can learn from Kissinger with respect to negotiations. In fact, negotiations are a common theme between these two books because the second book is by Wendy Sherman. Wendy is probably most recently known as the negotiator of the Iranian nuclear agreement in 2014 that stopped the Iranian nuclear advance. She was part of the team with John Kerry and Ernie Moniz, but the person that spent the most hundred or thousands of hours actually doing the negotiations. And that's only part of an extraordinary career. And from that career, she summarizes a number of things that folks like us might be interested in. Title of the book is Not for the Faint of Heart, Lessons in Courage, Power, and Persuasion. So, if I imagined holding an auction today for the opportunity to spend an hour with either of these folks, I think we would we'd have a four-digit winner. And you have the opportunity for free today to hear from both of them. As I say, the only price is you should buy a copy of the book at the end of the session, which will be back at the back. I had the good fortune to be one of the featured authors in this Boston Book Festival last year for the book that I wrote called Destined for War, Can the U.S. and China Escape Thucydides' Trap? About the rivalry between a rising China and a ruling U.S. and the Thucydidean dynamic that makes this extremely dangerous. So there'll be copies of my book at the back as well at the end. The Boston Book Festival was an extremely good thing for me last year because it helped propel the book to become a national bestseller. So we're trusting that you're going to help do that today. So what to say? I would say just the format. Each of the authors is going to take no more than 10 minutes to give us the elevator speech for their book and why it may be interesting to people that don't happen to be interested per se in the particular details of the Rhodesia-Zimbabwe negotiations that Jim describes in great detail and that are fascinating, but what we can take away from it that's useful for us. And similarly, Wendy will tell us not only from spending these thousands of hours negotiating with Iranians, but also before that in the Clinton administration negotiating with North Koreans, and before that, or through the course of that, negotiating in life, some lessons that are all, I think, ones that folks like us can use. So that's the plan. We're going to have them each speak for about 10 minutes, then I'll ask a couple of questions to get the conversation going. Then we'll have conversations by the audience. We stop sharply at 3:15. So, Jim, why don't you tell us why should we be interested in this book?
Well, I hope we don't stop at 3:15 because we're done.
Oh, I'm sorry.
4:15.
4:15. Sorry. Excuse me. 4:15.
Otherwise.
4:15.
Otherwise.
Yes, this was a great session. Thank you.
Declare victory. Why would somebody who was in college during the Vietnam War and had a perilously close to going to Vietnam draft number and someone who lives in Cambridge want to write a book that can be understood, I think wrongly, as glorifying Henry Kissinger. And I think the reason, which comes out of a process where I and a couple of colleagues have been interviewing great negotiators from around the world, including all the former secretaries of state through Hillary Clinton and soon John Kerry, possibly Rex Tillerson, Mike Pompeo, and we don't know how many more in short order. But but Kissinger, if you, interestingly, a poll of 1,600 international relations experts in the last year or so, of all stripes, from conservative to liberal, male, female, Marxist to all sorts of categorizations, overwhelmingly rated Kissinger as the most effective Secretary of State in the last 50 years. And lots of people have looked at his geopolitics. Lots of people have looked at particular negotiations. And the negotiations that he did were at a time of remarkable national turmoil. You'll remember everything from Kent State to the riots and demonstrations and Nixon ultimately resigning and so forth. So it was at a time of great polarization and the height of the Cold War. At that time, he was quite instrumental in opening the relations with China, which had been really silent vis-a-vis the U.S. in any official capacity for 20 years with a standoff and mutual demonization, calming things with detente and the first arms control deal with the Soviet Union. When the 1973 war broke out, he brokered disengagement agreements between Israel and Egypt and Syria and Israel, which have stood to this day. He managed through the Paris peace talks to extricate the U.S. from Vietnam, though those talks failed, or the deal failed after a while. And what's interesting is lots of people have looked at each of these cases and have looked at his geopolitics and foreign policy. But as a negotiation type, which is how I make my academic and professional living, curiously, no one had looked across all these situations and said, how did he do it? What can we learn about negotiation? Now, there are a whole lot of books and authors that will go chapter and verse as to why he's either a war criminal or an enlightened saint. And I think I've read them all. And I'm far less interested in that than I am in what we can learn, because it's a lot. Since when have we had a Secretary of State who fundamentally improved relations with China, with the then Soviet Union, stopped a war in the Middle East on a sustainable basis, got us out of a hot war? It's pretty remarkable when you think of it. And so the question is, what could we learn from Kissinger? And perhaps unexpectedly, Graham mentioned what was then Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe. And I'll just, I'm going to focus on that long ago, mostly forgotten set of negotiations as a way to suggest a few of the things that make Kissinger distinctive. And as somebody who studies public and private negotiations, I'm based at Harvard Business School, but I really do quite a lot on both sides of the aisle. These long forgotten negotiations where Kissinger probably improbably negotiated for black majority rule in what was then Rhodesia, 17 years before de Klerk and Mandela did the same and got rid of apartheid in South Africa. How did that happen? And if you look at negotiation, what most people's notion of negotiation is, the British exemplified it, because Rhodesia had been a colony, it was a breakaway state, and the Prime Minister of Great Britain, Harold Wilson, summoned Ian Smith, then the Prime Minister of Rhodesia, to the Rock, Gibraltar, aboard a British warship to negotiate the end of black majority rule as a condition of Rhodesian independence. And Smith came, Harold Wilson was flanked by his defense secretary or defense minister and his foreign secretary, and they confronted Smith, who basically said no and flew back. And they did this a couple of times. Well, that's the playbook for lots of people. Get them to come to you, located in an area, in a situation that appears where you've got a lot of power, and they'll capitulate. Kissinger, now why on earth would he get interested in this? Well, you may vaguely remember that the Cubans and the Soviets made a significant move in Angola. Kissinger tried to do a covert deal, but that was blocked. And so we essentially said, how do we keep Southern Africa from becoming a front in the Cold War? And he had an audacious notion that if the so-called frontline states, states that were all non-aligned with legendary figures like Julius Nyerere of Tanzania and so forth, if he could get them to say, we won't accept any foreign troops, he, Kissinger, would get Ian Smith, the head of Rhodesia, to permit black majority rule within 2 years. He pulled it off without military and without money. And the question is, how? By some pretty remarkable negotiation, which is even more remarkable if you realize that the way he did it was getting, of all people, all countries, the South Africans to put the arm on the Rhodesians to get rid of white minority rule. Now, that's got to be a puzzle for anybody interested in negotiation. And, you know, negotiation of it's a foreign policy situation, but the ingredients of that are really interesting. You're in an apparently very, you know, vulnerable position, and how does Kissinger get the South Africans to do something that would seem to be in their interest? Well, here's where you begin to see Kissinger, the characteristics that cut across, and I find them highly valuable in lots of other settings. Kissinger does what I think of as frequently zooming out to a broader perspective, to a strategy, and then zooming in intimately to his direct counterpart, and zooming back out to the strategy and in interpersonally, so strategic and interpersonal. And it's not like you formulate a strategy and then execute it interpersonally. There's a dialogue between these consistently, and one informs the other, because lots of times you've got to shift your strategy as you learn more from the people and so forth. But so you see this zooming in, zooming out. The zooming out was a complex coalitional strategy that involved the U.S., Gerald Ford, that involved the British, that involved a number of African states, and then approaching John Forster, the then Prime Minister of South Africa, and talking to him. Meanwhile, what I didn't tell you is when Kissinger thought he was going to go negotiate with Ian Smith, he at that point he was asked at the airport, what are you going to do to persuade Smith? What are you going to say when you meet him? And Kissinger said, I don't plan to meet him. And what he needed to do was create a context within which Smith would be likely to say yes. It wasn't realistic for Smith to say yes, because no was much more attractive until Kissinger built this coalition. How did he do it? It's a fascinating story, but that's where the zooming in piece becomes fascinating. Kissinger just sparkled during the interviews when we talked about him dealing with Julius Nyerere, the head of Tanzania. Now, this is a Marxist, deeply suspicious of the United States. Remember, this is just after Vietnam. The two admired each other, and he genuinely enjoyed that interaction. And Nyerere, a remarkable guy who had translated the works of Shakespeare into Swahili, and Kissinger, if you permit the Soviets and the Cubans in, your government isn't that strong, and besides, it's going to take a long time to get the whites out of Rhodesia. We can help. Pulls it off. He goes to South Africa. South Africa's feeling deeply isolated. He offers a path out of isolation. South Africa is feeling a lot of military and economic pressure. And Kissinger also says, look, Rhodesia's going to fall. And at that point, a radical will come in. And if you help me now to negotiate Smith's acceptance of black majority rule, a moderate will likely come in. And he was persuasive. And then with Ian Smith, then he imagined, he sort of said, how can he both be highly empathetic, which is not a word most people associate with Henry Kissinger, to Smith's situation, while at the same time being quite assertive about the situation. And this combination of empathy and assertiveness, I think, was really key in pulling this off. He did it. It was regarded as around the world as a staggering diplomatic triumph, as avoiding a bloodbath in southern Africa, particularly of the whites. Now, it turned bad because the election soon of Robert Mugabe was a triumph for democratic principle, but it turned sour otherwise. But you look at this and you say, okay, what's here? This zooming in, zooming out. This careful looking at incentives to really understand why would somebody say yes, and changing the game such that they will say yes. Really going back and forth between empathy to understand, assertiveness back and forth, and if you track these negotiations carefully, he has a plan, but things change all the time. Negotiation is not a recipe or a blueprint that you methodically execute. Instead, It's something like jazz, highly improvisational around a clear theme and a clear objective. And I think some of those things, which sound like high politics, and frankly, I think most people see Kissinger, as people see him in many particular ways, as sort of a geopolitical grandmaster moving pieces around a board, but highly interpersonal. And that's something that surprised me and my co-authors as we looked at it. But I think some of these lessons are intriguing, and I hope you'll find it so and learn about, frankly, some of the most important negotiations of the last century that really shaped our world. And really what my interest is how one can be most effective. Frankly, I've come to think of this book, though I've written hundreds of case studies of negotiators at Harvard Business School and been involved in the public and private sector, as almost the ultimate negotiation case study, although it's book length, so I wouldn't inflict it on my students.
Thank you. So thank you very much, Jim, and I thank you for trying to provide a capsule of some lessons that we might even use. So, Wendy, tell us about this extraordinary book, Not for the Faint of Heart, including how you chose such a title.
Thank you. Great to be with you all. And if you see us sort of looking off to the left here, it's because there's a timekeeper to make sure we don't babble on for too long. I think that as Graham said, many people know me as someone who spent a lot of time with Iranians. But when I finished government service and I left and I was reflecting on what I had done, which now has been undone by the president, I thought about how did I ever get here? Or as my husband, who is here in the back of the room today, said to me, how did a nice Jewish girl from Northwest Baltimore end up sitting opposite Iranians negotiating a nuclear deal when she's a social worker? How did that happen? Where did I learn how to do this? And there are several things that I hope the book points out. The book tries to integrate both negotiation experiences I've had in diplomacy, Iran, North Korea, Cuba, Middle East peace, two of which made some progress, two of which are pretty stuck, two of which have now been undone, Cuba and Iran, along with lessons in my life, which gave me the tools to be able to do that. And the underlying point of the book is what we learn in life helps us to negotiate in whatever we do. My daughter's here with my little grandchildren. Any parent here knows that if you have a 2-year-old or a teenager, you know how to negotiate. The trick is to draw those lessons out and to use them whether you are sitting opposite the Iranians or a North Korean leader who leads a cult, not a country, or you can do it in your own life, in your personal relationships, in getting a better salary at work, in dealing with people. The second sort of underlying theme in this book is that you are your best and most powerful when you are authentically who you are. If I have time later, I'll tell you the story of having burst into tears in front of the Iranians, not a technique or a tactic I'd ever encourage anyone to adopt, but turned out to be tremendously effective, and it is something I do when I get very angry. Somewhere along the line, I learned I wasn't supposed to get angry, but it was okay to cry. Some of you may have a similar experience. And so I was who I was, and it ended up being incredibly effective. The third thing is that I wish everybody an unexpected life. I tell students, and I'm going to join these colleagues as the new director of the Center for Public Leadership at Harvard and a professor of practice in January. But I tell students all the time, just get your first job. The best things will come to you that you never even imagined, and that is what's happened to me. I started out in social work as the director of child welfare. I then went into politics, ran Barbara Mikulski's first successful campaign for the U.S. Senate. Then I went on to do presidential politics and got this call out of the blue, would I come meet Warren Christopher? It's a story I won't tell right now, but I ended up doing national security and foreign policy in both the public sector and the private sector ever since. And my life gave me then tremendous opportunities. When it comes to those negotiations, the book covers 2, 4, 6, 7 chapters for your concern and your interest. First, to do any of these things takes courage. President Obama showed great courage to open his hand to Iran and to agree to a negotiation. There's a story in this book about my own family where my father and my mother took on a civil rights challenge that cost my parents their business, but it was the right thing to do to try to end housing discrimination in the city of Baltimore. Doing the right thing comes with a cost. President Obama and other people of courage certainly paid a cost for trying to reach out in diplomacy, but it's crucial to be able to negotiate successfully. You have to find common ground with the people who are sitting across the table from you. In my case with the Iranians, sometimes it was sharing photos of our grandchildren because my counterpart on the other side became a grandparent at the same time I did. Didn't mean we didn't go into the negotiation room and beat the brains out of each other afterwards, but it showed us a little humanity, and in more complex ways, one works to find common ground. Third, understanding power and how to use it. I think particularly for women, power is often thought of as an icky thing. Power is a terrific thing. And it's best when it's used, of course, for good purposes. And so it's a chapter on how you bring that power to a negotiation and make use of it. Letting go. There are many times in life when things cannot get done. Middle East peace is certainly one that's been tried and tried and tried again, and one can never get to the answer. Just when you think you might get there, someone assassinates the Prime Minister of Israel, and you're almost back to square one. The next chapter is on building a team to do anything in life. You know, most people know in the Iran negotiation about President Obama, Secretary Kerry, Secretary Moniz, maybe even me, but I had a core team of 15 people and literally hundreds of people in the U.S. government that helped to get this done. Last two, persistence. I'm taking a deep breath here because I don't think anyone these days who believes in social justice, equality, family values, U.S. values, doesn't believe in the need to persist. When the Women's March happened the day after the inauguration, my daughter, some of her friends were at our house in Washington. We were making signs, and I said, I cannot believe I'm still protesting this bullshit all these years later. And so they insisted that become my sign. Of course, enough of a public figure, I put BS, not bullshit, on the sign. But indeed, certainly after the Kavanaugh hearings and one of the other incidents is my book around negotiation. I helped Anita Hill to navigate the U.S. Congress for the weekend that she was up there. And so persistence is crucial, and certainly on the Iran deal, we have to continue to persist to ensure the peace and security of the United States and the world. And then last chapter before the painful epilogue is about success. Success rarely happens that is final in life, and certainly not in diplomacy or in war. World War I happened. It was the war to end all wars, and 20 years later, which is just a blip in the history of time, we had World War II. The Iran deal, we got to success, and it got undone in a year later. So we know that we have to persist. We know we have to try and try again. It doesn't mean there aren't moments of success, and when there are, we should celebrate. Besides my own family, the greatest piece of success that I've had was electing Barbara Mikulski to be the first Democratic woman ever elected in her own right to the U.S. Senate. It was pure, unadulterated joy, particularly because, coming back to the beginning of this, she taught me what is important. You have to be who you are. She was 4 feet 11 inches tall. As she said, togas did not come in a size 14 petite. She was 14 petite then. Now she's a little more comfortably round than that. But she said, this is what the Senate is, and this is what the Senate will be. So our power, our chance of success, our ability to persist, all come from who we are authentically, and our ability to come to the negotiation tool with all of these tools at our disposal. And the last point I'll make, and Jim and I were just talking about this the other day, most people think of negotiations as what you do in that negotiating room. And that is certainly important, and I quite agree with the zoom in, zoom out approach that Kissinger uses. But one has to set the table. One has to use all the outside forces, as he did with South Africa. One has to look at the entire landscape. So finally, on Iran, I used to joke, but only half joke, I negotiated inside the administration. I negotiated with every one of the permanent members of the Security Council of Germany and the European Union who were my negotiating partners. I negotiated with Israel. I negotiated with all the Gulf states. I negotiated with the U.S. Congress. I negotiated with academics who wanted to tell me how to do this. I negotiated with think tankers. Oh, yeah, occasionally I negotiated with Iran. I hope you enjoy the book. Life, Negotiations, is not for the faint of heart. It takes courage, power, and persistence, but can have phenomenal results. Thank you.
So if you're not interested in these two books by now, you came to the wrong meeting. So having had the good fortune to read both of them, you've just heard just teasers of many points, each of which they drill down and then tell us more about. So we're going to have a little conversation here, and then we're going to take some questions from the audience. Just even, I have had some questions prepared, but listening to the two of you, I think of about 20 more questions. So let me see if we do one that we maybe you each might address. So if we take things that are currently on the national agenda, let's take North Korea.
Let's do that.
For example. Wendy has actually been to Pyongyang and tried to deal with not Kim Jong-un, but his father, and tells about this in the book. So here we have a North Korea that has a nuclear arsenal today and whose leader, Kim Jong-un, has agreed with President Trump that he's going to eliminate that nuclear arsenal. And that's what he said. That's what he's agreed. No, not like that completely. It's what he said. And he repeats this. Whether he means it and whether he'll do it, that's a yet a further question. So the agreement in principle, you achieved many, many times in an agreement that never became operational. And that's not uncommon in negotiating, to agree to something, but then the details unravel the thing to which you agreed. So, Wendy, let me start with you. If you were, let's say, Secretary Pompeo, Secretary of State, he's a serious person trying now to operationalize a general framework that Trump and Kim Jong-un have at least subscribed to. So what would you suggest to him?
Well, I supported President Trump and Kim Jong-un to have the summit in Singapore. And the reason I did is because they are both leaders who believe they're the only ones who matter. Now, Kim Jong-un, in his country, is pretty much the only one who matters because if he doesn't like you, he kills you, which he did to his uncle and his entire uncle's family 2 weeks after he became leader of North Korea. And President Trump, who actually lives in a democracy where there are checks and balances, he is the one who was elected president, and he believes absolutely that he is the only one who matters and who decides. And so I thought, well, maybe this different approach, this top-down approach, which isn't usually the way diplomacy is done, would have some benefit. But I believed it would only have benefit if it was part of a strategy and a plan where the table had been well set, was going to continue to be well set, sanctions, where our military was, what we were saying publicly, what the public diplomacy was, whether we'd worked out things with all of our allies and partners in Asia and around the world, that he had a team ready to go to actually go forward, because the president certainly in even a day-long meeting was not going to get this resolved. It was going to be many months of negotiations. And as it turned out, none of that was really in place at the time of the Singapore summit. And so the piece of paper that came out of that was the thinnest document out of any negotiation ever done with North Korea. Secretary Pompeo, I think, has tried to rescue some of that He's tried to bring a team together. He's now brought in Steve Biegun, whom I know quite well, who's very capable, very smart professional. But there is a couple of significant obstacles. When I negotiated, whether it was Iran, Middle East, North Korea, Cuba, I always knew the president had my back. I knew that the rug would never be pulled out from under me. There was a policy process. I knew what the right and left margins of the policy were. I knew what the objectives were. I knew how far I could go. The presidents that I worked with, President Clinton, President Obama, knew the details that I was working on. And so I knew the rug wouldn't be pulled out from under me. And neither Secretary Pompeo nor Steve Biegun can be sure that President Trump won't pull the rug out from under them. He's already done that with Secretary Pompeo around sanctions. When the president said, I'll meet anytime, anywhere, without conditions, and then Secretary Pompeo said, well, on Iran, actually not so much. Here are 14 conditions before we sit down with the Iranian leader. So this will be very complicated. I'm glad they're not testing missiles. I'm glad they're not testing nuclear weapons. That's a good thing. But there are miles to go, and the North Koreans' definition of what denuclearization is fundamentally different than ours. Ours is fundamentally different than South Korea's. We may be closest to Japan's definition of denuclearization, but there is a very, very, very long way to go here.
Okay. I think we would be well served if we set this problem to you and you had to wrestle with it.
But no.
Jim, if you're offering thoughts on the basis of Kissinger's clues for somebody like Pompeo and Steve Biegun who are trying to deal with the problem that we have today. Yeah.
The first thing I would do is say, accept everything that Wendy said and underscore it, because I'm a big fan of hers and her approach and the direct analysis. In fact, when we interviewed Colin Powell, who was Secretary of State immediately after Madeleine Albright, with whom you went to North Korea and got apparently pretty close to something real, he wanted to continue. He thought it was in the U.S. national interest and got cut off by Rumsfeld and Cheney and company. So I think there was a sense that that was a great missed opportunity. And that was at a time before anything like the current arsenal was in place. So if I were, you know, in short order, looking at it through sort of Kissingerian negotiating eyes, if I look at zooming out to a broader strategy, I don't see much. If I see zooming in to an interpersonal piece, I see an enormous faith on the interpersonal aspect. But it's not really clear how that's going to hold. And if you look at, certainly you look at Donald Trump as a negotiator in the private sector, which is a business school professor I've done at some length, you would see that his early negotiations were pretty impressive, Grand Hyatt and the Trump Tower and so forth. But later, the characterization would be he would sweet talk people for a little, but fundamentally kind of a bully, pretty zero sum in his orientation, highly transactional, almost no loyalty to any of his partners once things changed or otherwise. So it's really hard to see how that intense interpersonal focus is going to work, except if he's flattered and he gets a deal that has a, you know, that looks like a good deal, but the substance may elude him, the same way as the financial piece did on the other. So I would, you know, the missing zoom out piece is, I think, a broader strategy. You know, Kissinger was also highly realistic in the sense of someone only makes a deal if a deal looks better than no deal. Mm-hmm. And right now, no deal looks pretty good to the North Koreans. So how can you shift that balance? I see no meaningful way to do that other than in close concert with South Korea and Japan and others in the area, and an orchestrated way to shift things so a deal comes to look to be more valuable than no deal. And that requires changing the game, not just focusing on big one person to another person, and frankly, a lot of multi-party dexterity, which we're really seeing, don't bother with all that complexity. We're just going to go straight to it, mano a mano. And that sounds good, and it gets good headlines, and I must give him credit for changing the dialogue, which felt like a rush to war and really dangerous. That seemed to have calmed down. In the interim, let's hope. I think there's a lot of hope on Secretary Pompeo and all the people who are advising them.
But if I looked at the zoom-out pieces of Kissinger, strategic, realistic, game-changing as necessary to shift the deal-no-deal balance, and quite dexterous in pulling together alliances, I think I find that missing. And I think Wendy provides the ingredients.
Good. Well, I think that would be good advice for the Secretary, and I think helpful. Wendy, let me get you to, I mean, you have so many wonderful cases in your in the book, but if you take one of them and compare it to the Stabenius summary of Kissinger's negotiations as reflected, for example, in the Rhodesia Zimbabwe, so how does that framework look for one of the problems you wrestled with? Either, I mean, one of the nice things about the book, actually, you didn't mention in your earlier part, is the virtues of failure as a learning experience. So either from one that worked or didn't work, how would the Sabinius analogy be relevant?
I think the one to really focus on is Middle East peace. In the sense that that failure has faced every single president. Every president comes in sure that they can make peace in the Middle East. Bill Clinton got close, but Yasser Arafat, there were two problems, and one of the problems was a zoom-out problem. He got close, and Arafat said that he would come to Taba, the last meeting actually post the Clinton presidency, and say yes. But Arafat could never get to yes in the end, in part because he was more a leader of a movement than he was a leader of a government, and he couldn't see himself that way. But even more than that, there was a zoom-out problem. I think President Clinton has said subsequently, we didn't spend enough time dealing with the Gulf, and with Saudi Arabia in particular, an interesting country today, which we could talk about in the Q&A. But Saudi Arabia is the keeper of the holy mosque in Jerusalem. And one really can't get to Middle East peace without an acceptance by the Gulf states. And we really did not put in enough time working on that piece of the puzzle and getting them on board to give Arafat the support that he needed to say yes. When Rabin was still alive, I think we were on our way, because Rabin famously said that he knew he had to put his arm around Arafat and hold him up, that Arafat did not have the strength or the constituency or the experience to make the enormous leap he was going to have to make. And the day that Rabin was assassinated, I had, I guess, the honor to go to Rabin's funeral and take members of Congress over to Israel for that funeral. And very strange, I shared a night sleeping with Jesse Helms and Chris Dodd. One of the strangest nights of my life.
Not all the details are in the book.
Right, not all the details are in the book. But it was one of the few trips Jesse Helms ever made abroad, because as conservative as he was, he understood the weight of all of this. And that funeral brought to it, for the first time, the King of Jordan, who had been to Israel before but never publicly, the president of Egypt, for the first time ever to Israel. So Rabin's death brought to this environment the possibility of enormous change. But for a number of other reasons, some of which I discuss in the book, we weren't able to capitalize on it. So those outside-in elements, as you discussed, Jim, about Rhodesia, were fundamental to getting to peace in the Middle East. Heaven only knows, the entire world has tried to make this happen, and we haven't been able to pull it off yet. Ripeness certainly matters, of course.
Sure. So, Jim, may I ask you the obverse of this? So as you think about Wendy's cases and the lessons that she draws from them, what would you say?
Well, I would actually first strongly agree with what you say around the Middle East and Israelis and Palestinians. If you were to look at it
The average Israeli right now says, you know, life's pretty good. We've got defense. We have security cooperation with the Palestinian Authority, which itself detests Hamas. It isn't widely trumpeted, but it's very much there. Life's pretty good. And, you know, we withdrew from southern Lebanon, and we got Hezbollah. And we withdrew from Gaza, and we got Hamas, and we're not doing that again. It's too costly, too risky. So a deal looks bad, and no deal's not bad. And everybody keeps saying it's going to not last, but they've always said, right? So the elements of a deal aren't there. And in fact, if you draw the circle around those two players, I don't think there's elements for a deal. I think what you are saying, that you need to move more broadly. And frankly, I think the presence right now of Iran as an increasing regional threat to the Gulf states, to the Saudis, as well as the Iranians, and the Egyptians, there's a commonality of purpose, which the Israelis would very much like to have much more a stronger alliance there, if that were possible. Without some meaningful progress on the Palestinians, that can't really be done, because politically in the Gulf states and Saudi Arabia, unless there's some meaningful progress toward the Palestinians, it's just not on in the kind of level that it would be. So you can imagine something where you zoom out and you build again in a region where all of a sudden the Israelis say, gee, we get security benefits, especially vis-a-vis Iran and ISIS or whatever ISIS 3.0 is, and the Muslim Brotherhood and so forth. If we get that, if we can pull this together, maybe the conditions. But that's a kind of a big picture, and actually making it happen is daunting. People are really fatigued with the prospect of negotiation. On the other hand, you know, you look at a country like Colombia, where 50 years of fighting between the government and the FARC, 250,000 people killed, 5 million displaced, and they actually got a deal, barely rejected by the population, but most of the elements appear to be finding their way back. And there were endless tries. The negotiation fatigue was enormous. You look at these possibilities, it can be done. You know, conflicts are made by human beings. Conflicts can be undone by human beings. It takes persistence, but smarts. And I think you see that in your book all the way through.
Okay, so now there's going to be an opportunity for questions from the audience. Questions, stand up, tell us who you are, and a question is short and ends with a question mark.
Right here.
Doesn't work. Okay.
Thank you.
So thank you very much. I would like to have a sense of how you folks who deal with negotiation feel about us folks, the public. I assume that in many ways we're a bit of a nuisance because, you know, we're not necessarily aware of all those things that we can. With regard to Mr. Kissinger in particular, since I was drafted during the Vietnam era, and I had my life disrupted, not as badly as people who actually got to go there, in order to keep dominoes from folding, I'd just like to point out that the T-shirt I'm wearing, which was bought at Costco, was made in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. So much for dominoes, so much for what we were essentially fed. I realize that how we feel is complicated, but I'd really like to have some statement that says that, you know, you're aware of the fact that we're around and ultimately we're the ones to pay the price.
Good question.
Good question.
Wendy, you want to start?
Yeah. I certainly have always been aware when I've been negotiating of the public and of public opinion for a couple of reasons. One, now in life my husband does public opinion research, so I hear the data all the time. But more than that, particularly these days, if I go on MSNBC, my Twitter feed tells me exactly what people think, instantaneously, for good and for ill. And I'm came of political age during the Vietnam War. I'm certainly defined by that violent and horrible time. So I think it matters enormously to what negotiators do. It is part of that outside environment that Jim spoke so much about, because it is constantly you have to be aware of all the pieces in the environment, everything that is going on. And that's everything from what the public is feeling and thinking, but it is often, when you're at the negotiating table, sifted through think tanks, sifted through political leaders, sifted through pundits like I am now on TV. And the harder part is to get a real fingertip sense of what people are thinking and feeling. And you know, we're not a monolith, as I know you appreciate. And so we certainly know that we have divisions in our society, that you may have one point of view and another part of the society has another point of view. And I need to, as a negotiator, understand that there isn't one point of view out there that represents everybody in terms of what we're doing. And then the last thing I'll say is that the presidents who have the greatest courage sometimes do things that, at least initially, everybody is against. That's one of my little grandchildren chirping away, so I can't be annoyed by it. So we can't say that there's never a time when you don't go forward, because real leadership is sometimes not going with what the polling numbers say. It's about leading and taking people to where you think will really create peace and security and prosperity. And sometimes that's not apparent in people's day-to-day lives.
So, Jim, on Vietnam, because that's a very relevant subject, Kissinger would argue, I'm a student of Kissinger's, that Nixon was elected, there were 500,000 Americans fighting in Vietnam. At the end of it, they were out of Vietnam. So they were about inheriting a war which they escaped from. And with respect to public opinion, he would say, there's some reason why Johnson didn't run. That's the answer, is people were against the war. And so basically a president decided not to run for re-election. And there's some reason why Nixon got elected. That's another story. But in any case, in office, what they were about was taking account of the fact that Americans didn't want to fight in Vietnam anymore and wanted to find a way to escape. So what about that?
The hard question with what you said, and by the way, I completely agree with it, 550,000 troops in 1968, brought down by a couple of 100,000 within a year or two, and down to 25,000 by 1973. There was a dramatic reduction. Imagine if you're on the North Korean side, knowing that there are demonstrations and riots and a commitment to draw down troops. And as Lee Duc Tho stared at Kissinger early on and said, look, the South Vietnamese couldn't win with 500,000 of your troops here. How do you think you're going to win with none of them here? And, you know, paradoxically, that's actually quite a weak position if you think about it. I think the hard question there is, if that was the case, why hold on from 69 through 1973? Because if it was going to end up the way it did anyway, with North Vietnam taking over, then why not just leave and avoid all that damage and loss of life and people maimed, and some of whom were in my friends at the time, because I was in college at that point and very close to it. And it's a complicated argument, and I think it points up one of the things about negotiation. I actually, looking close at the negotiating side of Vietnam, as a technical matter, I actually think it's something of a tour de force. And that may seem very counterintuitive. I'm not going to go into why, but it's really from a fundamentally pretty weak position how one can deal with it. But what Henry Kissinger and Richard Nixon were doing was negotiating on behalf of a series of assumptions, specifically that this was primarily a front in the Cold War between the Soviets and Chinese and the Americans, that American credibility around the world with respect to all kinds of foreign policy questions was perhaps fatally at stake, that Vietnamization had a fighting chance of actually working, and if they did a deal, it could be enforced. And at the time, many people contested each and every one of those assumptions, and afterwards they all turned out to be wrong. And I think that's the big lesson. You know, I focus on how you get things done. I don't focus as much on what you should be doing. But if you're a virtuoso negotiator on behalf of flawed assumptions, you might get to the wrong place more efficiently,
right? And I think there is a, you know, a really powerful lesson so that could, technique matters.
We could have a long debate among the here.
But I just
would say the alternative interpretation would be there was Senator Aiken, who was up in Vermont. He said, declare victory and retreat. Mm-hmm. That was his proposal for getting out of Vietnam. If somebody could do some equivalent of that in Iraq or in Afghanistan today, I would vote for it.
Yes.
And Kissinger's may be a version of that, just with a more smoke and mirrors. Back here. Please.
Okay, but then you have to...
The most consistent issue in my 65 years...
I'm not picking him.
Oh, okay.
Is it on?
I'm sorry, speak up.
Okay. Hello. I'm Tim Menke from Germany and a grad student at Harvard. The United States have pulled out of the Iran deal, but the remaining contractors have not. So where, Ambassador Sherman, do you see the future of the Iran deal?
Where do I see the future of the Iran deal? And I was whispering to Graham that the next questioner has to be a woman.
Yes.
So it's a rule of mine.
Give the microphone to a woman for next. Next question.
So,
go ahead.
Okay. So I think that the Europeans are trying very badly to hold on to the deal. I think the Iranians are trying very badly to hold on to the deal. I think the Iranians will watch what happens in our electoral politics. If they see that it is likely that President Trump will be president for 6 years more, they will have to find a way to a negotiating table, is my view, for everybody's sake, including ours, including mine. If they think that he won't be, if they think that there are more checks and balances coming to the U.S. Congress, and whatever your views are out here, I don't want to end this afternoon without urging everyone to vote. Take everybody you know to vote. If you can still register, register to vote. If you can early vote, early vote. If you can vote by absentee ballot, vote. Just vote.
This is Massachusetts where we say vote early and often.
Yes, that's fine, too. That's fine, too. But so I think that they will watch our politics very carefully to decide how long to hang on. People think of Iran as having no politics because they have a supreme leader, so they think that means everybody does whatever he says. They have quite complicated politics, and they have the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps is quite to the far right, even of President Rouhani, who is not a moderate by our standards whatsoever. I talk about the Iranians as hardliners and hardliners. So I think that people will try to hang on for now, but I don't know how long they'll be able to hang on, and some of that will depend upon our politics and whether Iran thinks it's going to have a window for things to get any better than they are right now.
Okay, very helpful. Please.
Hi, Ambassador Sherman. I wanted to know what you would do if you were in office right now related to our relationship with Saudi Arabia. Just a simple question.
Good. Good question.
I think that what is apparent that Saudi Arabia at the very top ordered the killing, assassination of Jamal Khashoggi is appalling, devastating, and has to be answered. And I appreciate that there are complicated issues here and that this is a very complicated ethical dilemma for a lot of people. I do. But it's not complicated for me. This is the United States of America. I do not hold President Trump responsible for the death of Jamal Khashoggi, but I do believe that his calling the press the enemy of the people, which is straight out of Stalin, by his saying that there's fake news when that in itself is fake, a fake concept, creates an atmosphere of impunity. And whether that is the death of Khashoggi or the likely imprisonment of the head of Interpol, whether it is the Reuters journalists being held in Myanmar, all over the world, journalism, free speech is being challenged, and so we have to answer it in the toughest terms possible. That's where I am.
Jim, do you want a word on that?
He's got another question.
He says he agrees. Okay.
The most consistent issue of my 65 years has been the Mideast. And I'm just curious how each of you reacted when you found out that Jared Kushner was going to play a prominent role in the Mideast, in the Mideast issues, and what that said to the rest of the world. What did it say to the rest of the world when that happened?
Okay, short answers. Jim?
What? No, Jim.
What do you think?
Hope is not a strategy.
Okay. Wendy?
Okay. I can't top that.
Okay. Next question.
Next question. That was perfect.
Short question, short. Go ahead. And, don't we have two microphones? Then pass them out in advance, please. Yes. And go ahead, a lady for the next one. No, a lady. Please, sir.
Yeah, perfect.
Since the office of the president has gotten so powerful, more than I think was originally intended, and since we know the kind of man who is now in that office, can you really have hope that negotiations, which eventually lead back to him, as he's responsible for foreign affairs, that he will make intelligent choices that will benefit others as well as the United States? I don't have that kind of faith in the man at the top, and the people below him are really responsible to him. So okay. What do you think of clear chances?
Clear question. If you have no confidence or limited confidence in the leader, can the system nonetheless produce good results? Yeah.
Fine. I think that the system can produce not the deep state, if you will, but competent people around and advising and otherwise can push things in a positive direction, but they have to do it in a way that makes the president look really good. And if he doesn't look good, I don't think any policy, whatever its broader merits, is very likely to be the outcome of a negotiation. Now, that just says something that we all know from negotiations, that often the internal is more challenging than the external. And I think that's the case here.
Wendy describes this as a Rubik's Cube,
right. So I'll give you one example where I think he did this more right than wrong. I think the USMCA is ridiculous, but that's the renegotiated NAFTA agreement. But he basically handed it over to the U.S. Trade Representative Lighthizer, gave him responsibility for the technical details. They worked on this for 2 years. They had a lot of technical people engaged. Ostensibly, that hopeful guy, Jared, had something to do with the Canadian piece of it. I don't know the truth of that. But nonetheless, they came to a result. Do I think it is a huge change from NAFTA? I do not. Do I think there are small changes that may be valuable? I do. Do I think it's worth what it did to our relationship with Canada and Mexico? Not so much. But as an example of a negotiation process in this administration that actually had substantive details, a strategy, a team, an objective, and an outcome, better than most.
And frankly, as a hardball player,
yes,
separating them and doing Mexico first, doing that deal, then the Canadians, this is classic divide and conquer.
We've come to the witching hour for one last question. This lady.
What is it going to take for us to rebuild our government? All the loss, and we have all the ambassadorships opening, we have all the defense, national security, I mean, go agency by agency. What will it take?
Wendy, you've worked in most of these.
Vote, yeah. vote. I mean, the State Department is hollowed out. Pompeo's doing a little bit better, but not much, quite frankly. The person who's replaced, took my job, the Undersecretary of Political Affairs, David Hale's a superb diplomat. So I'm really happy about that. But as you point out, There is not an ambassador in Turkey, for instance. There is not an ambassador in Saudi Arabia, for instance. So it makes it really tough to get the jobs done, not because there aren't capable people, just so people understand. There are very capable people. But countries want someone who is a representative of the President of the United States, confirmed by the United States Senate, so they know they have the authority to operate. And they don't exist. And so in a situation like Turkey and Saudi Arabia right now, Khashoggi, it is all much more difficult. So that is why my big message this afternoon is please do vote so that we can move forward and voices can be heard that we want those jobs filled. We want a government that functions. We want to keep our country safe.
Jim, last word, brief.
At the top, what Wendy said is absolutely right. But what scares me, perhaps more long term, is the exodus from the upper middle and the middle of competent people with lives. Yeah. Michael Lewis has just written a book that really details that in three departments, and it's chilling in terms of anyone who takes governance seriously.
Okay, so we have two books for sale at the back of the room, and actually, my.